Quentin a visit in his bedroom. When he first found it, the room had been stuffed with an appalling amount of hideous quasi-medieval junk. It had been literally centuries since all four of Whitespire's thrones had been filled at the same time, and in the meantime the extra royal suites had been invaded and occupied by creeping armies of superfluous candelabras, defunct chandeliers, listing and deflated like beached jellyfish, unplayable musical instruments, unreturnable diplomatic gifts, chairs and tables so piteously ornamental they would break if you looked at them, or even if you didn't. Dead animals ruthlessly stuffed in the very act of begging for mercy, urns and ewers and even less easily identifiable vessels that you didn't know whether to drink out of or go to the bathroom in. Quentin had had the room cleared out to the bare walls. Everything must go. He left the bed, one table, two chairs, a few of the better rugs, and some pleasing and/or politically expedient tapestries. That was all. He liked one tapestry in particular that depicted a marvelously appointed griffin frozen in the act of putting a company of foot soldiers to flight. It was supposed to symbolize the triumph of some group of long-dead people over some other group of long-dead people whom nobody had liked, but for some reason the griffin had cocked its head to one side in the midst of its rampage and was gazing directly out of its woven universe at the viewer, as if to say, "Yes, granted, I'm good at this, but is it really the best use of my time?" When it was finally empty, the room had grown by three times its size. It could breathe again. You could think in it. It turned out to be about as big as a basketball court, with a smooth stone floor, towering timbered ceilings where light got lost in the upper reaches and made interesting shadows, and soaring Gothic lead-glass windows, a few little panels of which actually opened. It was so gloriously still and empty that when you scuffed your foot on the stone, it echoed. It had the kind of hushed stillness that on earth you saw only from a distance, on the other side of a velvet rope. It was the stillness of a closed museum or a cathedral at night. There was some murmuring among the upper servants that such a Spartan chamber was not entirely suitable for a king of Fillory, but Quentin had decided that one of the good things about being a king of Fillory was that you got to decide what's suitable for a king of Fillory. And anyway, if it was a high royal style they wanted, the high king was their man. Elliot had a bottomless appetite for it. His bedroom was the gilded, diamond-studded, pearl-encrusted rococo lair of a god-king. Whatever else it was entirely suitable. "You know, in the Fillory books you could actually get into the tapestries?" It was late, after midnight, and Elliot was standing eye to eye with the woven griffin and sipping from a tumbler of something amber. "I know." Quentin was stretched out on the bed, wearing silk pajamas. "Believe me, I've tried. If they really did it, I have no idea how they did it. They just look like ordinary tapestries to me. They don't even move like in Harry Potter." Elliot had brought a tumbler for Quentin, too. Quentin hadn't drunk any yet, but he hadn't ruled out the possibility either. At any rate, he wasn't going to let Elliot drink it, which he would inevitably try to do when he was done with his own. Quentin had made a nest for the tumbler in the blankets next to him. "I'm not sure I'd want to get into this one," Elliot said. "I know. Sometimes I wonder if he's trying to get out." "Now, this fellow," he said, moving on to a full-length portrait of a knight in armor. "I wouldn't mind getting into his tapestry, if you know what I mean." "I get what you mean. Pull that sword out of its scabbard." "I get it." Elliot was building up to something, but there was no rushing him. Though if he took much longer, Quentin was going to fall asleep. "Do you think if I did, you'd see a little tapestry version of me running around in there?" "I don't know how I'd feel about that." Quentin waited. Since he'd made the decision to go to the outer island, he felt calmer than he had in ages. The windows were open, to the extent that they could be opened. and warm night air flowed in, smelling like late summer grass and the sea, which wasn't far off. "So about this trip of yours," Elliot said finally.
"About it?"
"I don't understand why you're doing this."
"Do you have to?"
"Something about the quests and adventures and whatever, sailing beyond the sunset. It doesn't matter. We don't need you here for the Jollibee thing. One of us really should go out there anyway. They probably don't even know they have kings and queens again. Just pass along any prurient details as a matter of state security."
"Will do.
But I want to talk to you about Julia."
"Oh."
Whiskey time. Trying to drink lying down, Quentin took a bigger swallow than he meant to, and it ignited a brush fire in his guts. He suppressed a cough.
"Look, you're only High King," he gasped. "You're not my dad. I'll figure it out."
"Don't get defensive. I just want to make sure you know what you're doing."
"And what if I don't?"
"Did I ever tell you," Elliot said, sitting on one of the two chairs, "how Julia and I met?"
"Well, sure."
Had he? The exact particulars were fuzzy.
I mean, not in granular detail.
The truth was that they hardly ever talked about that time. They talked around it. No good memories there for anybody. It was after the big disaster in Ember's tomb. Quentin had been half-dead and had to be left in the care of some irritating but ultimately very medically effective centaurs while Elliot and Janet and the others returned to the real world. Quentin had spent a year recovering in Fillory, then he went back to Earth and gave up magic. He spent another 6 months working in an office in Manhattan until Janet and Elliot and Julia finally came and got him. If they hadn't, he'd probably still be there. He was grateful, and he always would be. Elliot stared out the window into the black, moonless night, like an Oriental potentate in his dressing gown, which looked too heavily embroidered to be comfortable. "You know Janet and I were in pretty rough shape when we left Fillory."
"Yes, though at least Martin Chatwin hadn't chewed you practically in half."
"It's not a contest, but yes, that is true. But we were shaken up. We loved Alice too, you know, in our way. Even Janet did. And we thought we'd lost you as well as her. We were well and truly done with Fillory and all its goods and chattels, I can tell you." "Josh went home to his parents in New Hampshire, and Richard and Anais went off somewhere to do whatever it was they'd been doing before they went to Fillory. Not big mourners, those two. I couldn't face New York again, nor could I face my grotesque so-called family in Oregon. So I went home with Janet to L.A. That turned out to be an excellent decision. You know, her parents are lawyers, entertainment lawyers. Fantastically rich, huge house in Brentwood, working all the time, no discernible emotional life whatsoever. So we sucked around Brentwood for a week or two, until Janet's parents got tired of the sight of our post-traumatic faces shuffling off to bed as they were getting up for a pre-dawn squash match. They packed us off to a fancy spa in Wyoming for a couple of weeks. You wouldn't have heard of it. It was that kind of place, impossible to get into and ludicrously expensive. But money means nothing to these people, and I wasn't about to argue. Janet practically grew up there, the staff all knew her, from when she was a little girl. Imagine that, our Janet, a little girl. She and I had a bungalow to ourselves and positively legions of people to wait on us. I think Janet had a manicurist for every nail. And they did a thing with mud and hot stones. I swear to you there was magic in it. Nothing feels that good without magic. Of course, the terrible secret of places like that is that they're horrifically boring. You have no idea the extremes we were driven to. I played tennis. Me. They got very scoldy when it came to drinking on the court, I can tell you. I told them it's just part of my form. You can't relearn technique, not at my age. Well, by the third day, Janet and I were considering having sex with each other just to relieve the tedium.
and then, like a dark angel of mercy come to safeguard my virtue, Julia appeared. It was like one of those Poirot mysteries set at a posh country seat. There was some accident down by the pool. I was never clear on the details, but an enormous fuss was made. I suppose that's one of the things you pay for, first-class fuss. At any rate, the first time I laid eyes on our Julia, she was being carried through the lobby, strapped to a backboard, soaking wet and cursing a blue streak, and insisting that she was fine, absolutely fine. Take your paws off me, you damn dirty apes. The next day I came down to the bar around 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and there she was again, drinking alone, all in black. Vodka gimlets, I believe. The mysterious lady. It was painfully obvious that she didn't belong at the spa. Her hair was a rat's nest. You literally can't imagine. Worse than now, even. Her cuticles were bitten down to the quick. Shoulders hunched. Nervous stutter. And then she had no grasp of how things worked. She tried to tip the staff. She pronounced the names of French wines with an actual French accent. Of course, I was drawn to her at once. I figured she must be Russian, daughter of a jailed oligarch, that sort of thing. No one but a Russian could afford to stay there and still have hair that bad. Janet thought she was just out of rehab and, from the looks of it, headed right back in. Either way, we fell upon her like starving people. The approach was subtle. The trick was not setting off her alarms, which were all obviously set to a hair trigger. It was Janet, that mistress of seduction, who cracked her in the end. She planted herself in a public lounge and complained loudly about a rather involved computer issue. You could watch our Julia wrestle with herself, but it was a fait accompli. After that, well, you know how it is on those vacations. As soon as you learn another person's name, they become inescapable. We ran into each other everywhere. You wouldn't think a place like that was her style, would you? But there she was, up to her neck in mud, with cucumber slices over her eyes. She was constantly plunging in and out of baths and things. Once Janet tried to go in a steam bath with her, but she turned it up so high everybody else had to flee. Probably she had them thrash her with birch twigs. It was like she was trying to rid herself of some stubborn taint. It came out that she had a weakness for cards, so we spent hours just drinking and playing three-handed bridge, not talking. We didn't know she was a magician, of course. How could we? But you could tell she was bursting with some terrible secret. And she had those things that one likes about magicians. She was disgustingly bright and rather sad and slightly askew. To tell you the truth, I think one of the things we liked about her was that she reminded us of you. Well, you know how in the Poirot books he always goes on vacation to get away from it all, the mysteries and whatever else, only to have a murder committed on the very island he's fled to for peace and quiet and some civilized gastronomy. It was exactly like that, except that we were fleeing magic. One night I wandered over to her bungalow around 10 or 11 at night. Janet and I had had a fight, and I was looking for someone to complain about her to. When I passed Julia's window, I saw that she was building a fire. That was odd to begin with. The fireplaces were absolutely enormous in those bungalows, but it was the middle of summer, and nobody in their right mind was using them. But Julia had a roaring blaze going. She was building it very methodically, placing the logs very carefully. She marked each log before she put it on, scraped away some of the bark with a little silver knife. And then, as I watched, I don't know how to describe it so you'll understand, she kneeled down in front of the fire and began putting things in it. Some of the things were obviously valuable, a rare shell, an old book, a handful of gold dust. Some of them must have been precious to her. A piece of costume jewelry, an old photograph. Each time she'd put one in, she'd stop and wait a minute, but nothing happened, except that whatever it was burned or melted and gave off a nasty smell. I don't know what she was waiting for, but whatever it was never came. Meanwhile, she seemed to get more and more agitated. I felt utterly tawdry spying on her, but I couldn't look away. Finally, she ran out of precious things, and then she started crying, and then she put herself into the fire. She crawled over the hearth and collapsed, half in and half out of the flames, sobbing her little heart out. Her legs were sticking out. It was awful to see. Her clothes went up right away, of course, and her face got black with soot, but the fire never touched her skin. She was absolutely sobbing. Her shoulders shook and shook. Elliot stood up and went to the window. He struggled with one of the little panes for a second. Then he must have found a catch Quentin had never noticed, because he pulled the whole window open. Quentin couldn't see how he did it. He put his glass on the sill. "I don't know if you're falling in love with her, or if you just think you are, or what it is you're doing," he said. "I suppose I can't blame you. You always did like to make things as hard as possible on yourself. But just listen to what I'm telling you." That was how it all started, how we knew she was one of us. The spell was something very strong. I could hear the hum of it even over the fire, and the light in the room had gone a funny color. But so much of her magic is just impossible to parse. I knew right away she'd never been to Breakbills because it sounded like gibberish to me, and I couldn't get within 1,000 miles of how it worked or what she was trying to do, and she never said, and I never asked. But if I absolutely had to guess, I'd say she was attempting a summoning. I'd say she was trying to bring back something that she'd lost or that was taken away from her, something that was very precious to her indeed. And if I had another guess, I'd have to say that it wasn't working.
Chapter 3. The next morning, Quentin rode down to the docks in a black carriage with velvet curtains and plushly padded velvet seats. It was safe and musty inside, like a living room on wheels. Next to him, swaying loosely with the rocking of the carriage, sat Queen Julia. Across from them, their knees practically touching, was the Admiral of the Felorian Navy. Quentin had decided that if he was going on a trip to the island at the ass end of the universe, he should do it properly. He should make preparations. There were rules for this kind of thing, such as, if you were going on a journey, you needed a stout vessel. All ships were available to the Crown in theory, but most of the ones they kept just lying around on call were warships, and those turned out to be scarily Spartan on the inside. Rows of hammocks and racks of hard pallets, not a stateroom in sight. Not really suitable at all for the voyage of King Quentin, K-W-E-N-T-I-N, as Elliot liked to spell Quentin's name in official documents. So they were going down to the docks to find a ship that was suitable. Quentin was feeling good. He was full of energy and determination that he hadn't felt for a long time. This is what he'd been waiting for. The Admiral was an almost alarmingly short man named Lacker, with a thin gray face that looked like it had been hollowed out of schist by the action of 50 years of wind and spray. It wasn't that Quentin couldn't have said what he was looking for, it's just that he didn't want to, because if he did, it would have been embarrassing. What he was looking for was a ship from one of the Fillory novels, specifically the Swift, which figured in the fourth book, The Secret Sea. Pursued by the Watcherwoman, Jane and Rupert, he could have explained to Admiral Lacker, but didn't, had stowed away on the Swift, which turned out to be run by pirates, except they were only pretending to be pirates. They were really a party of Fillorian noblemen, wrongly accused, who were seeking to clear their names. You never got a particularly nautically rigorous look at the Swift, but you nonetheless came away with a powerful impression of it. It was a plucky but cozy little vessel, elegant to look at but game in a fight, with sleek lines and glowing yellow portholes through which one glimpsed snug, ship-shape cabins.
Of course, if this were a Fillory novel, the ship he needed would already be tied up at the docks, awaiting his command, just like that. But this wasn't a Fillory novel. This was Fillory. So it was up to him.
"I need something not too big and not too small," he said, "medium-sized. And it should be comfortable, and quick, and sturdy."
"I see. Will you require guns?"
"No guns. Well, maybe a few guns. A few guns."
"A few guns."
"If you please, Admiral, don't be a cock. I'll know it when I see it, and if for some reason I don't, you tell me. All right?" Admiral Lacker inclined his head almost imperceptibly to indicate that they had a deal. He would endeavor to be as little of a cock as possible. Whitespire stood on the shore of a wide, curving bay of oddly pale green sea. It was almost too perfect. It could have been carved out of the coastline on purpose by some divine being who took a benevolent interest in mortals having somewhere to put their ships when they weren't using them. For all Quentin knew, it had been. He had the driver drop them at one end of the waterfront. They clambered out, all three of them, blinking in the early morning sun after the swaying dimness of the carriage. The air was ripe with the smell of salt and wood and tar. It was intoxicating, like huffing pure oxygen.
"All right," Quentin said. "Let's do this." He clapped his hands together.
They walked slowly all the way from one end of the docks to the other, stepping over taut guy ropes and squashed and dried fish carcasses, and weaving their way around massive stanchions and windlasses, and through labyrinths of stacked crates. The waterfront was home to an astounding variety of vessels from all points of the Fillorian Empire and beyond. There was a gargantuan dreadnought made of black wood, with nine masts and a bounding panther for a figurehead, and a square-snouted junk with a brick-red sail crimped into sections by battens. There were sloops and cutters, galleons and schooners, menacing corvettes and tiny darting caravels. It was like a bathtub full of expensive bath toys. It took an hour to reach the far end. Quentin turned to Admiral Lacker. "So, what did you think?"
"I think the Hatchet, the Mayfly, or the Morgan Downs would suffice."
"Probably. I'm sure you're right. Julia?"
Julia had said almost nothing the entire time. She was detached, like she was sleepwalking. He thought about what Elliot had told him last night. He wondered if Julia had found whatever it was she'd been looking for. Maybe she was hoping she'd find it on the outer island.
"It does not matter. They are all fine, Quentin. It makes no difference."
They were both right, of course. There were plenty of decent-looking ships, beautiful even. But they weren't the Swift. Quentin folded his arms and squinted down the length of the docks in the late morning glare. He looked out at the ships floating in the bay.
"What about those ones out there?"
Lacker pursed his lips. Julia looked, too. Her eyes were still black from the day before, and she didn't have to shade them against the sun. She looked right into it.
"They are at your disposal as well, Your Highness," Lacker said. "Of course."
Julia walked out along the nearest pier, straight-backed and sure-footed, to where a humble fishing smack was tied up. She jumped the gap neatly and began untying it.
"Come on," she called.
Lacker gestured to Quentin to precede him.
"Sometimes you just have to do things, Quentin," Julia said, as he climbed on board after her. "You spend too much of your time waiting."
It was good to get out on the open water, but there wasn't much wind, and as it warmed up, the smack began to smell. Amazingly, its owner emerged from below decks, where he must have been asleep. He was a sun- and wind-burned man with a gray beard, wearing overalls with nothing obviously on underneath them. Lacker addressed him in a language Quentin didn't recognize. He didn't seem at all put out or even surprised to discover that his boat had been commandeered by two monarchs and an admiral.
As for Lacker, he looked unfairly comfortable in the heat, in his full-dress uniform, as they toured an even greater variety of inappropriate vessels. Most of them were out there because their drafts were too deep to anchor any farther in. A great bruiser of a ship of the line, some nobleman's bloated party yacht, a fat, butter-colored merchant tub. "What about that one?" Quentin said. He pointed.
"I beg your indulgence, Your Highness. My eyesight has suffered in the service of our great nation. You do not mean..."
"I do. Enough with the period drama. That one, there." A flat sandbar projected from one of the horns of Whitespire's great bay. A ship lay near it in a few feet of water. The low tide had laid it gently down on one side on the sandy bottom, its underbelly exposed like a beached whale.
"That ship, Your Highness, has not left the bay for a very long time."
"Nevertheless..." It was partly out of thoroughness, partly out of a perverse desire to pay the Admiral back for being, his promise notwithstanding, a little bit of a cock. The owner of the smack exchanged a long look with Admiral Lacker. "This man," the look said, "loves his land."
"Let us return to the Morgan Downs."
"And we will," Julia said. "But King Quentin wishes to see that ship first." It took 10 minutes to tack over to it, the sails flapping as the fisherman gamely worked his way upwind. Quentin reminded himself to pay the man something for this after. They circled the wreck listlessly in the shallow water. Its hull had been painted white, but the paint had been weathered and blasted down to the gray wood. There was something odd about its lines, something curiously swoopy about them. It finished in a long, slender bowsprit that had been snapped off halfway. He liked it. It was neither harsh and blocky like a warship, nor soft and too pretty like a yacht. It was elegant, but it meant business. Too bad it was a carcass and not a ship. Maybe if he'd gotten here 50 years earlier...
"What do you think?"
The smack's keel scraped the sandy bottom loudly in the stillness. Admiral Lacker regarded the horizon line. He cleared his throat.
"I think," he said, "that that ship has seen better days."
"What do you think it was?"
"Workhorse,"
the smack's owner piped up huskily.
"Deer class, ran the route between here and Longfall."
Quentin hadn't even realized he spoke English. "It looks nice," Quentin said. "Or it looked nice."
"That was,"
Admiral Lacker said solemnly,
"one of the most beautiful ships that was ever made."
He couldn't tell if Lacker was joking or not, except that it was pretty obvious that he never joked. "Really?" Quentin said.
"Nothing moved like the Deer class," Lacker said. "They were built to carry Bergspar from Longfall, then Cold Spite on the way back. Fast and tough. You could ride them to hell and back."
"Huh. So why aren't there more of them?"
"Longfall ran out of Bergspar,"
the fisherman said.
Now he'd gone all chatty. "So we stopped sending them Cold Spice. That was the end of the Deer class. Most were broken up for the clockwood in them, sold for scrap. It was the Lorians built them. Every shipwright and fillery tried to copy them, but there was a trick to it. Trick's been lost." "My first command," Lacker said, "was a very fast picket out of Hartheim. Nothing in the service could have caught us. But I saw a Deer class blow by me once on its way north. We had studding sails set on both sides, made us look like we were standing still."
Quentin nodded. He stood up in the boat. A halo of little birds lifted off from the ship's blasted hull, stalled for a moment on a puff of wind, and then settled back down again. The smack had come around to the far side, and they could see the deck, which was stove in at least 2 places. The ship's name was painted across the stern. Muntjac. This wasn't a fillery novel. If it were, this was the kind of boat he'd have.
"Well, I think that settles it," he said. "Take us back to the Morgan Downs, please."
"The Morgan Downs, Highness."
"And when we get there, tell the captain of the Morgan Downs to get his floating rat trap over here and haul that thing," he pointed at the Muntjac, "into dry dock. We're taking it."
That felt good. Some things it was never too late for. Getting the Muntjac, it turned out to be the name of a species of deer, into anything like seaworthy condition was going to take a couple of weeks, even if Quentin exercised his royal prerogatives and press-ganged all the best shipwrights in the city, which he did. But that was fine. It gave him time for more preparations. He'd been sitting on his nervous energy for so long it was good to have something to do with it, and he was discovering how much of it he had. He could have powered a small city with it. The next day, Quentin had an announcement posted in every town square in the country. He was going to hold a tournament. In all honesty, Quentin had only a very vague idea of how tournaments worked, or even what they were, except that they were something kings used to do at some point between when Jesus was alive and when Shakespeare was alive, which was as close as Quentin could get to placing when the Middle Ages had actually happened. He knew that tournaments were supposed to involve jousting, and he also knew that he wasn't interested in jousting. Too weird and phallic. Plus, it was hard on the horses. Sword fighting, though, that was interesting. Not fencing, or not just fencing. He didn't want anything that formal. He had in mind something more like mixed martial arts, ultimate fighting. He wanted to know who the best swordsman in the realm was. The no-buts, fuck-you-all-fillery champion of sword-fighting. So he put the word out. A week from now, anyone who thought he could handle a blade should turn up at Castle Whitespire and start whacking till there was no one left to whack. Winner gets a small but very choice castle in the Fillorian boondocks and the honor of guarding the king's royal person on his upcoming journey to an undisclosed location. Elliot walked in while Quentin was clearing the grand banquet hall. A column of footmen was filing out, carrying a chair each.
"Pardon me, Your Highness," Elliot said, "but what the hell are you doing?"
"Sorry, it's the only room that was big enough for the matches."
This is the part where I'm supposed to say, "Matches? What matches?"
"For the tournament. Sword fighting. You didn't see the posters?" "The table goes to," Quentin said to the housekeeper who was directing the move. "Just put it in the hall."
"I'm having a tournament to find the best swordsman in Fillory."
"Well, can't you have it outside?"
"What if it rains?"
"What if I want to eat something?"
"I told them to serve dinner in your receiving room, so you'll have to do your receiving somewhere else. Maybe you can do that outside."
A man was on his hands and knees on the floor, ruling out the pist with a lump of chalk.
"Quentin," Elliot said, "I just heard from someone in the Shipwrights Guild. Do you have any idea what that ship of yours is costing us? The Jackalope or whatever it is?"
"No, the Muntjac."
"About 20 years' worth of Outer Island taxes, that's how much it's costing us," Elliot said, answering his own question, "just in case you were curious about how much it's costing us."
"I wasn't that curious."
"But you do see the irony?"
Quentin considered this. "I do, but it's not about the money."
"What's it about, then?"
"It's about observing good form," Quentin said. "You, of all people, know all about that."
Elliot sighed.
"I suppose I can see that," he said. "And I need this. That's all I can tell you."
Elliot nodded.
"I can see that, too."
Contestants began trickling into the city a few days later. They were a bizarre menagerie, men and women, tall and short, haunted and feral, scarred and branded, and shaved and tattooed. There was an ambulatory skeleton and an animated suit of armor. They carried swords that glowed and buzzed and burned and sang. A handsome pair of conjoined twins offered to enter individually and, in the event that they vanquished the field, gallantly declared themselves willing to fight each other. An intelligent sword arrived, borne on a silk pillow, and explained that it wished to enter. It merely required somebody willing to wield it. On the first day of the tournament, there were so many pairings that some of the bouts had to be held outside after all, on wooden stages set up in the courtyards. A circus atmosphere prevailed. The weather was just turning. It was the first cold morning of the year, and the fighters' breath smoked in the dawn air. They performed all kinds of weird stretches and warm-ups on the wet grass. It was everything Quentin had hoped for. He couldn't sit still long enough to watch a whole match. There was always something unmissable going on in the next ring over. Shouts and clashes and weird war cries and even less easily identifiable noises broke the early morning calm. It was like being in a battle, but minus all the death and suffering. It was three full days before the contestants worked their way through the draw to the final pairing. There were a few incidents and explosions along the way, where forbidden weaponry or major magic overpowered the safeguards they'd put in place, but no one was hurt too badly, thank God. Before it started, he'd had a romantic idea about entering the tournament himself in disguise, but he could see now what a disaster that would have been. He wouldn't have lasted 30 seconds. Quentin oversaw the final match himself. Elliot and Janet condescended to attend, though such grunting, sweaty exercises were beneath Queen Julia's notice. Various barons and other court grandees and hangers-on sat in a row against the walls of the banquet hall, which looked woefully unmartial. He wished he'd done it outside, after all. The last two fighters entered together, side by side, but not speaking. After all that, they looked oddly alike. A man and a woman, both slender, both of average height, nothing outwardly extraordinary about either of them. They were cool and serious, and they showed no obvious animosity for each other. They were professionals drawn from the upper tiers of the Mercenaries Guild. They were just here to transact business. Whatever violence they had stored up in their lean, compact bodies was still latent for the time being, fissile, but inactive. The woman was called Arrol. The man's name, absurdly enough, was Bingle. Arrol fought veiled and tightly swathed, like a ninja. She had a reputation as an elegant fighter who made a fetish of her technique. Nobody had been able to break her form, let alone touch her. Her sword was an oddity. It was curved slightly and then recurved in the form of an elongated letter S. Pretty, but a pain to carry around, Quentin thought. You couldn't fit it in a scabbard. Bingle was an olive-colored man with hooded eyes that gave him a permanently melancholy look. He wore what might once have been an officer's uniform, from which the bars and trim had been snipped, and he fought with a thin, flexible, whip-like blade with a complicated basket hilt that didn't look Philorian. Though he'd won all his matches, the buzz on him was that he'd managed it without doing a lot of actual fighting. One infamous duel started in the morning and ran almost till sundown, while Bingle engaged in an endless series of feints and evasions. The whole tournament was held up while they waited for the bracket to be filled. In another match, Bingle's opponent waited till the opening bell had rung and then calmly stepped over the chalk line, out of bounds, for an automatic forfeit. Apparently they'd met before, and once had been enough. Quentin was looking forward to watching somebody make Bingle actually stand and fight. Quentin nodded to the Master of Sword to start the match. Arrol began a sequence of highly stylized movements, drawing fluid shapes in the air with her recurved blade.
She didn't approach her opponent. She seemed to be lost in concentration, practicing some ritualized, almost abstract martial art. Bingle watched her for a little bit, flicking the tip of his sword around uneasily. Then he joined the dance. He began performing the same movements as his opponent. They became mirror images of each other. Apparently they were adepts of the same style and had chosen to open with the same form. Laughter rippled through the crowd, and it was funny, like a mime copying a passerby. But neither of the fighters laughed. Afterward, Quentin wasn't sure exactly when this preamble ended and the fighting began. The two combatants passed too near each other, and it was like a candle flame accidentally brushing a curtain. A spark jumped the gap, the symmetry was broken, the fissile material reached criticality, and suddenly the room was full of the rapid-fire clatter of steel colliding with steel. At this level of mastery, the action went too fast for Quentin to follow. The precise details of the moves and counter-moves and negotiations were lost on everybody but the combatants. Their shared style was all arcs and spins and constant motion, as each side looked for openings and found only dead ends. You got the impression they were reading each other down to an atomic level, logging tiny twitches and tells and shifts of weight. The passes would start beautifully, set sequences that sometimes even included a flip or a somersault. Then the flow would break, and everything would be chaos until the blades tangled up and locked, and they disengaged and started all over again. Jesus, Quentin thought, and he was going to get on a boat with one of these people. It was a little too real, but it was electrifying, too. These were people who knew exactly what they were meant to do and never hesitated to do it, whether they won or lost. Then, all at once, it was over. Errol overextended herself with a huge overhand chop that Bingle just managed to roll out from under, and by blind chance her blade stuck fast in the floor in a crack between two flagstones. Coming up out of the roll, Bingle kicked at it reflexively, and it snapped neatly halfway along its length. Errol stepped back, not bothering to conceal her frustration, and indicated that she conceded the match. But Bingle shook his head. Apparently he wasn't happy with the grounds of his victory. He wanted to keep fighting. He looked at Quentin for a ruling. So did everybody else. Well, if he wanted to play by good guy rules, then by all means. Quentin wouldn't mind seeing some more fighting himself. He drew his sword and offered it to Errol, hilt first. She felt the balance, nodded grudgingly, then resumed her fighting stance. The match recommenced. 5 minutes later, Bingle jumped a low cut and attempted some mid-air finesse move that got tangled up in Errol's ninja wrappings. He wound up right next to her, inside her guard, and she punched him savagely in the ribs 3 times. He grunted and staggered backward toward the chalk line, and Quentin was sure he was going to ring out, but at the last second he realized where he was. He spun around and leaped balletically for the wall, pushed off it, turned head over heels, and landed lightly on his feet just in bounds. The crowd gasped and applauded. It was a circus move, stagey and over the top. Errol irritably pulled off her headscarf and shook out a surprising mass of wavy, auburn hair before resuming her stance. "Bet you anything she practiced that in a mirror," Elliot whispered. The dynamic of the fight had changed. Now Bingle dropped the formal balletic style they'd both been using. Quentin had assumed that that was where his training was, but it soon became apparent that he was some kind of technical freak, because he seemed to be able to shift styles at will. He went at her like a berserker, fast and furious, then cycled rapidly through a courtly dueling mode to a kind of shouting, stamping, kendo style. Errol grew increasingly flummoxed, trying to adjust, which was presumably what Bingle was after. Breaking her silence, she shouted something and lunged flat out. Bingle met her attack with a parry so implausible it was vaudevillian. He stopped her blade, Quentin's blade, with the tip of his, so that the two swords met point to point. They bent ominously, almost double, for an unendurably tense second. There was a worrying saw-blade sound of flexed metal, and then Bingle's sword snapped with a sharp, vibrant twang. He had to jerk his head to one side to avoid a flying shard. He threw his useless hilt at Errol in disgust. The pommel clunked her on the temple, but she shrugged it off. She paused, evidently considering offering him the same largesse he'd offered her. Then, having made some inner calculation, probably having to do with honor and principles and castles, she aimed an overhand cutting stroke at Bingle's shoulder, the coup de grace. Bingle closed his eyes and dropped rapidly to one knee. As the blade descended, he didn't dodge, just brought his hands together smoothly and decisively in front of him. And then time stopped. At first, Quentin wasn't sure what had happened. But the room exploded in amazement. He stood up to get a better view. Bingle had stopped the blade between the palms of his hands, in mid-strike, bare flesh, against sharp steel. He must have calculated the move down to the last erg and arc and nanosecond. It took a moment for Errol to understand what he'd done, and Bingle didn't waste it. With the advantage of surprise, he jerked the blade toward himself out of her grip. He flipped it smartly, the hilt smacking solidly into his palm, and placed the blade at her throat. The match was over.
"Oh, my God," Elliot said. "Did you see that? Oh, my God!"
The assembled barons forgot their noble reserve. They got to their feet, huzzaing, and mobbed the winner. Quentin and Elliot cheered along with them. But Bingle didn't seem to see them. Those hooded eyes never changed their expression. He pushed his way through the crowd to Quentin's throne, where he kneeled and offered Quentin back his sword. The next time Quentin visited the waterfront, the Muntjac was crawling with workmen, like piranhas on an unlucky Amazonian explorer, except in reverse. They were putting the Muntjac back together, bringing it back to life. There was no part of it that wasn't being aggressively sanded or varnished or tightened or reinforced or replaced. They'd got it up into dry dock, propped it up on a forest of stilts, fixed the sprung boards, caulked and tarred and painted it. Out-of-sync hammer blows clattered from all quarters of the hull. As it turned out, the ship's structural elements had been basically sound, which was good, because the shipwrights didn't think they could have reproduced what they found. Deep in the hold, pieced into some of the complex joins near the prow, they'd found a complicated lump of wooden clockwork connected to taut lines leading off into various parts of the ship. They couldn't figure out what it was for, so Quentin told them to leave it alone. The Muntjac's hull was now a smart jet black with bright white trim. Hundreds of yards of new sail were even now being sewn by an army of sailmakers, an astonishingly technical process that took place in a vast, airy sail loft the size of an airplane hangar. The sharp, honest fragrances of sawdust and wet paint bloomed in the air. Quentin breathed them in. He felt like he was coming back to life, too. Not that he'd been dead, just not quite alive. Something else. With only two or three more days till the Muntjac could be floated, Quentin paid a visit to Castle Whitespire's map room to see what he could learn about his destination. The outer island was the least exciting part of this whole undertaking, but he'd better at least be able to find it. After the clamor of the docks, the map room was a reservoir of cool quiet. One whole wall was windows, and the other was taken up with a glorious floor-to-ceiling map of Fillory, from Loria in the north to the wandering desert in the south. The map was traversed by a rolling library ladder, so you could get right up close to the part you wanted to study, and the closer you looked, the more detail resolved itself, to the point where you could pick out individual trees in the Queenswood. No dryads, though. The map was lightly animated by some subtle cartographical magic.
You could follow tiny combers in as they pounded the swept coast, one after the other. Quentin leaned in. You could even hear them faintly, like the roar in a shell.
A line of shadow was advancing across the map, showing where it was night and where it was day in Fillory. Overhead, on the vaulted ceiling, tiny stars twinkled in the velvety blue-black of a celestial map that showed the Fillorian constellations. This was Quentin's kingdom, the land he ruled. It looked so fresh and green and magical like this. This was Fillory, the way he'd thought of it as a little kid, before he'd ever been here. It looked like the maps printed on the endpapers of the Fillory and Further books. He could have watched it all day. The map room wasn't exactly a hive of activity. The only visible staff was a surly teenager with thick black bangs that fell over his eyes. He was bent over a table, furiously working some kind of calculation using a collection of steel cartographical instruments. It took him a minute to look up and realize that he had a patron. The boy gave his name, grudgingly, as Benedict. He might have been 16. Quentin had a feeling that not a lot of people came through the map room, and still less often were those people kings. At any rate, Benedict was out of practice at showing the appropriate amount of deference. Quentin sympathized. Personally, he could take or leave the bowing and scraping, but he still needed a map. "What can you show me that has the outer island on it?" Benedict's eyes went blank for a second as he queried some mental database. Then he turned away and dragged himself over to a wall that was honeycombed with little square drawers. He yanked one out. They turned out to be thin but very deep, and extracted the single scroll it contained. The centerpiece of the map room was a heavy wooden table with an elaborate brass mechanism bolted to it. Benedict nimbly fitted the scroll into it and cranked a handle. It was the only thing he did with anything remotely resembling alacrity. The crank unrolled the scroll and spread it out flat so you could get a good look at the section you wanted. It was a lot longer than Quentin expected. Yards of almost blank parchment scrolled by as Benedict cranked, showing curves and arcs of latitude and longitude, or whatever the Fillorian equivalents were, traversing miles of open ocean. Finally he stopped at a tiny, irregular nugget of land, with its name underneath it in italic script, The Outer Island. "That must be the place," Quentin said dryly. Benedict would neither confirm nor deny this. He was painfully uncomfortable making eye contact. Quentin couldn't think who Benedict reminded him of until he realized that this was what he had probably looked like to other people when he was 16. Fear of everybody and everything, hidden behind a mask of contempt, with the greatest contempt of all reserved for himself. "It looks pretty far out," Quentin said. "How many days sail?" "Dunno," Benedict said, which wasn't quite true, because he added, obviously in spite of himself, "3, maybe. It's 477 miles, nautical miles." "What's the difference?"
"Nautical's longer."
"How much?"
265 yards longer," Benedict said automatically, "and a bit."
Quentin was impressed. Somebody must have managed to beat some information into Benedict somehow. The brass map reader had many articulated arms that extended seductively outward, each one with a posable lens on it. Quentin swiveled one around, and a magnified version of the outer island swam into view. It was roughly peanut-shaped, with a star marked on it at one end. Its border was a thick, dark line, with a fainter outline around it, doubling it, as if to suggest waves, or maybe the submerged edge of the landmass under the water. It was about what he expected. A fine black thread, a single, lonely stream, wandered from the interior down to the coast. Next to the star was the word Outer, in smaller letters. Presumably that was the name of the island's one town.
The lens failed to reveal anything else. All it did was make the fine grain of the parchment look coarse.
Who lives there?
Fishermen, I guess. There's an agent of the crown there. That's why it has a star.
They looked at the star together.
It's a shit map,
Benedict volunteered. He leaned down so that his nose almost touched it.
Look at the shading. Why do you want to know about it?
I'm going there.
Really? Why?
That's actually a pretty good question.
Are you looking for the key?
No, I'm not looking for the key. What key?
There's a fairy tale,
Benedict said, as if he were explaining to a kindergartner.
That's where the key that winds up the world is. Supposed to be.
Quentin wasn't wildly interested in Falorian folklore. Why don't you come along, he said. You could make a new map of it if this one's so bad.
Now he was a counselor of troubled youth. Something about the boy made Quentin want to shake him up, get him out of his comfort zone, so he could stop sneering at everybody else who was out of theirs. Get him thinking about something besides his own neuroses for a change. It was harder than it looked.
I'm not rated for field work,
Benedict mumbled, dropping his gaze again.
I'm a cartographer, not a surveyor.
Quentin watched Benedict's eyes keep getting drawn back to the map, to that irregular peanut. Maps of places, rather than actual places, were obviously where young Master Benedict preferred to live.
The line work is...
He made a noise through his teeth.
Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ was an expression the younger Falorians had picked up from their new rulers. It was impossible to explain to them what it actually meant. They were convinced it was something dirty. In the name of the Kingdom of Fillory, Quentin intoned, I hereby pronounce you rated for field work. Good enough? Should have brought my sword, Benedict shrugged, embarrassed. It was exactly what Quentin would have done 10 years ago. Quentin almost found himself liking the kid. He probably thought nobody could possibly understand how he felt. It made Quentin realize how far he'd come. Maybe he could help Benedict. Think about it. We should bring somebody to update the maps. Though the draftsmanship looked fine to Quentin. Idly, he turned the crank of the brass map-viewing contraption. It really was very neat. Little half-concealed gears spun, and the outer island drifted away and was rolled up on the far side of the scroll. He kept cranking. Yards and yards of creamy blank paper passed by, decorated here and there with dotted lines and tiny numbers. Empty ocean. Finally, the scroll ran out, and the loose end popped out and flapped around. "Not much out there," he said, since he felt like he should say something.
"It's the last scroll in the catalogue," Benedict said. "No one's even looked at it since I've been here."
"Can I take it with me?" Benedict hesitated. "It's okay. I am king, you know. It's my map anyway, if you want to be technical about it."
"I still have to sign it out."
Benedict carefully rolled up the scroll and placed it in a leather case, then gave him a slip of paper that allowed him to take it out of the map room. He had co-signed it. His full name was Benedict Fenwick. Benedict Fenwick. Jesus Christ, no wonder he was sulky. Quentin had an obsolete sailing ship that had been raised from the dead. He had a psychotically effective swordsman and an enigmatic witch queen.
It wasn't the Fellowship of the Ring, but then again he wasn't trying to save the world from Sauron. He was attempting to perform a tax audit on a bunch of Hick Islanders.
It would definitely do. They left Castle Whitespire 3 weeks to the day after Jollibee died. A stiff salt breeze was scouring the waterfront. The Muntjac's sails looked ready to lap it up and race off over the horizon in search of more.
They were a glorious white with a very pale blue ram of fillery splashed across them like a watermark, their edges snapping and vibrating with barely contained excitement. It really was a marvelous beast. A brass band played on the waterfront. The conductor was visibly urging his charges to greater